You're listening to The Spirit Hunters, a member of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find out about our pod brethren and how to join our now public and free Discord group and support the show at podcast.hyperx.com and patreon.com/spirithunterpod.
If you're a shrewd shopper, it's about to be your favorite time of the year. HyperX will be running massive sales for the holiday season. Get up to 50% off some of our most popular products, like the ultra-comfy Cloud 2 headset, the tough, responsive Alloy Origins mechanical keyboard, and the fan-favorite Quadcast USB microphone. Sales will be going on at all major e-tailers, but be sure to head to HyperX.com and sign up for the newsletter to get the scoop on the biggest deals. Happy holidays from HyperX.
Welcome to Season 3, Episode 24 of The Spirit Hunters. This is Hannah,
Joe,
Sarah,
and Megan. Hello.
Hello. So, last time, Kamugi woke up her nun, Merriam's Kokoro went doki doki, and Poof began his descent into anti-fandom while the extermination team went over the infiltration plans into the palace. This week, it's a bunch of planning and scheming by humans and ants alike as the selection draws closer and closer. You better get ready.
Yo, Megan, you want to tell us about episode 110?
Yeah. Okay, so episode 110 is named Confusion and Expectation, or Konwaku to, what is it to? Yeah, Konwaku to Omuwaku. Waku.
Wait, what does waku waku mean? Waku. Because like that's definitely an onomatopoeia that I have heard.
It's exciting. I'm gonna Google it because I don't want to mess it up.
I wonder if it's a slightly different heartbeat or something.
Anya does it in Spy Family. She says it all the time.
Yeah,
waku waku.
It's also the name of a fighting game from back in the day that was kind of a comedy fighting game called Waku Waku 7.
Oh,
Waku Waku. It means waku, pleasing waku, or thrilling, according to the random Wikipedia. Like Waku Waku Suru. Wait, is that the thing? Yeah. It's like an actual word. Is it an onomatopoeia? It is an onomatopoeia.
We honestly need to do just like an episode about all Japanese onomatopoeia.
There's too many. Yeah, doki doki, waku waku. People are asking like the difference versus. But you can use it like literal. I'm pretty sure you can use it like waku waku shita, like I am excited, versus just like as like an onomatopoeia. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like, can be used as an adjective or a. Is that an adjective? I don't know English.
Yeah, I guess it's an adjective. I mean, depending on, I don't know what the construction's like in Japanese. Yeah. In English, it's an adjective by virtue of being like a
descriptor,
past participle or something.
Yeah. So I think those are words.
I might be misremembering that, but it's like a past form of a verb that can also be used as an adjective.
Yeah. So that's that. So it's a word, but also a onomatopoeia, where it's an onomatopoeia that can be turned into a word. Because you don't,
I'd be
really
curious to know the direction, but we'll figure that out another time.
Yeah. Otherwise, it was originally released in Japan on December 25th. Merry Christmas.
Yeah,
happy
Merry
birthday,
Christmas,
Jesus.
Everyone.
Happy birthday, 2013. And then the equivalent manga chapters are 261 and 262 that's released on Japan. In Japan on October 6th, 2007.
I was starting college.
Oh, yeah. About to say, how old was everybody? I was in the 7th grade or maybe the 6th. I can't remember.
We just started high school. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. We started high school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, October. Yeah. Oh, actually, this is 3 days after me and Tommy got together.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. This is about right at that time when me and Tommy started dating, right?
Oh,
happy
so you
three
guys
days later anniversary, you two.
Thank you. Yeah, we I'm gonna do this in quotes, dating, because I was 13, October 3rd, 2007.
So it was like the Full Metal Alchemist Day and Mean Girls Day.
Anniversary. We get a we get a special anime slash Mean Girls Day.
Was that on purpose?
Yeah, I really thought ahead of time in 2007 when the movie was 3 years old and the internet was in its infancy.
Can't believe y'all burned down your house. Anyways, Sarah, you want to tell us a little bit about the episode?
Yeah, so the synopsis of 110 is that the extermination team decides to charge into the palace using the closest to the exit by the central staircase. And then we have Wilfin, canine detective. He discovers not just one, but two infiltrators who are apparently in cahoots with each other. And he goes on the hunt to sniff him down using Nove's shoes and then ordering Bizef to bring him Palm's clothes. And it's sad girl hour for Kamugi. She's alone in her room, not playing Gungi with the king. And she still is sad that she doesn't know his name. While in the throne room, Miriam is smacking down Yopi. He's shooting down P2's end security plans in favor of his own, and then driving up Poof's anxiety and dread. And then we have Bizef. He brings Wilfin the clothes and then gets tricked by him into thinking that the infiltrators have planted a bomb within the palace. And Wilfin is scheming to become the Shadow King, aka the real ruler behind the scenes calling the shots. And back in Nove's dimension, the extermination team wait a whole 7 minutes before going over their plans. Ikago and Knuckle argue with Killua over exceptions plans, including kind of awkward birds in the ants talk, which goes over Gon's head. Killua's has a very bad feeling that whoever the mysterious third party is going to ruin any plans they make. And then finally, with 1 minute left, the extermination team is ready to rumble. And that's it.
What do you guys think of this episode?
I was expecting like the action to start now, but I do like the fact that I was building even more tension, and I guess like especially with the what's happening with Bizef and Wilfin is like Wilfin's very sneaky. He's more like a fox than a wolf, to be honest.
I was thinking about that too.
Yeah, but it was a good episode. I'm like, I'm ready for the action, but also dreading it. So I was kind of relieved that it wasn't as like, you know, it wasn't like boom, boom, boom yet. So.
Yeah, it wasn't boom, boom. It was more like waku, waku.
Yeah.
Yeah, I purposefully chose the way to divide these episodes such that like the start would be the next time we'd record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's really definitely just like a setup transition. We're waiting to like see what's going to go down. Just kind of setting up for, because I think once this episode's over, I'm pretty sure is that the final stretch?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty dark, like, yeah. You have like the tournament of power is here.
Yeah, it's now.
I was going to say something that's interesting that I didn't really notice until this viewing is I forgot most of the events of this episode, which is interesting because they weave in and out of the rest of this part of the series. But the reason I forgot them is because they're kind of in the background. Like the effects of this are kind of in the background, like the stuff with Wilfin and all that stuff. And it's reminiscent in a way that I'm not going to explain of like when people make nonfiction accounts of people in a town that's about to be bombed and don't realize it yet, you know, just them going about their regular day and like their petty arguments and like the things that they go through just as part of everyday life right before something terrible happens. And it feels that way. Like it is a military dictatorship run by ants, but it's still an everyday event for them.
I like how you mentioned that because it reminded me of that, like, duck and cover. I don't remember. I watched some propaganda, or was it actual like fire safety training about when I was a kid about nuclear disasters? And like, it kind of starts off. It's an anime, guys. I could be wrong. Is there an anime about a 15-minute anime where it shows the events leading up to Hiroshima or Nagasaki?
I think I've seen clips or something to that effect, but I don't know of it.
Okay. Because it does exactly that, right? It goes through their day until the alarm hits, and then everything after. Or it could have been, yeah, I think it, I'll look it up, but that's what you described was basically that real life example in Hunter, you know.
Huh, that's interesting. I never really thought about that, because it is something where it almost seems everything's just business for both parties involved. Like, the ants are just like a normal day conducting business before like their big event, and also the hunters are doing some basic planning before their big event. It just happens to be either a genocide or an infiltration plan. So it's interesting to think about that way. Wolfen definitely surprised me, because it's like he's a character I never really paid that much attention to before. So having this episode be a focus on him for pretty much half of it, I thought was pretty interesting. I'm just like wondering if it's just a way to show that all the ants don't necessarily have the same agenda, or if there's like a, what's it called? Like a Chekhov's gun or something, like this is going to somehow really affect either the ant side of things in this war, basically. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
You'll find out. And I don't think we should say anything either way. But one thing I do think is kind of interesting with that is he kind of reminds me of Lael, and how Lael was trying to get people to owe him favors. And Megan said the name of the manga in a chat. I'll get to that in a second. But like, basically the idea of getting people to owe him favors, and the idea of like surreptitiously getting more influence, which is, you know, an element of court intrigue you often see in tales of like, you know, the royal court. And like, effectively, this is a royal court. There's literally a king. And, you know, I mean, he has like a royal vizier in the form of Poof, and then like two other people who I don't know the exact analog for. You know, I'm going with the three wise men thing, just going with Merum as the promised birth. But beyond that, I don't know. But Megan, if you want to explain the name of it.
Yeah, it's Barefoot. I can't pronounce my letters. Gen. Barefoot Gen. It's essentially a telling of the Hiroshima bomb that drops, but there's like a whole like 15-minute scene where it draws out the whole explosion and all the aftermath immediately after, and then I think the rest of the movie kind of takes place with like what's going on after everything. But the beginning part is exactly that. They're just kind of like, oh, just a normal day, getting some groceries, playing with sticks, like hanging out, and then it drops. I think I watched this in high school, like I watched this in class.
What year was this?
1983.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So the reason I ask is because the 1979 Gundam show kind of starts like that, not a nuclear bomb, but basically a military attack on like where the main characters live, and like basically the rest of their friends and family are like immediately killed, and they just like barely escape, and it's like the first fucking episode. But it kind of does the whole like, hey, you know, average day, the war is never coming here.
Yeah. Or it's here, but like, we'll give you a warning, like it'll be fine, like it's just up there. Yeah. So what year was that? 1970s?
Yeah, 1979. Okay. But like, honestly, there's probably an earlier thing, is because I bet in the realm of nonfiction writing, people have probably done stuff like this forever.
The manga came out, let me double check really quick, because Barefoot Gen was based off of a manga.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah, the manga could be earlier, because there's no pre-existing Gundam manga before the anime.
Yes. It was by Keiji Nakazawa. From 1973.
Okay, yeah.
To 1987. So, probably. So yeah, nice. About actually pretty simultaneously with Gundam.
No, so it like probably that. Actually it probably influenced Gundam, or there might be a third older source. Okay. But to get back to Hunter x Hunter, what did you guys think of the weird Hina fucking fan service thing?
I didn't really get it. I don't know why it was there.
It's way more fan servicey in the manga in a way that's like kind of interesting that I'll talk about later. But what did you think about it as described here, as shown here?
It was just weird. Was it shown before? Right? With the belly? Why did she look pregnant? And I'm like,
that was shown. Because I remember the conversation, and I guess it's like exposition wise, she absorbed Leol's Nen, right? And that's why she looked like she had a food baby, but was it technically a Nen baby? And she was talking about like, oh, it's this girl, it's my figure, blah, blah, blah. And she was talking to that like one aunt thing. It's like, oh, I wish you could talk, even though you're like a peon, you can understand speech, but you can't. Like respond back to me sort of deal. So I didn't really get the purpose of it, other than I don't know, fan service and a little bit of like exposition. Yeah, but I don't know
the importance. I think of there it. Is a reason it, but it's one that I don't think we can really talk about.
There's a fan service reason and there's a secondary reason.
Okay. Yeah, the stuff around her priorities kind of secondary reason.
Yeah. It's like the fan like, service is super unnecessary because
it's like when I looked at it, I was like, I had to do a double take because I didn't really understand what I was looking at, because it just, she like covered all her bits in like this, all this fur, so in ways it was kind of like typical fan service. At the same time, it wasn't. It just looked like she was wearing like a cat's the Broadway play costume.
That's what I figured you were saying. Yeah. So it's I normally don't want to bring up the manga differences right now, but I'll say it now. In the manga version, it is way more explicit because you see her back first, and you do not get like, and she's submerged in the water in such a way that you don't see that hair thing. Mm-hmm. So she just looks nude at first, and it's clearly titillating. But then, you know, so there's like a legion of people who are probably like really horny about this, and then they show her with the hair thing being like pregnant. And my theory is way less people are horny about this, but the people who are still horny about this are much hornier.
Yeah, that's what I thought, you know. There's a demographic for it.
Oh, it is a thing.
Go ahead.
I was about to say, I didn't realize this scene was like, as many times as we watched this anime, I missed it even this time watching it around. I don't know why. But it, like, if you take the screenshot that I see, it just kind of looks like pubic hair. So it looks even more like graphic.
Yeah, she looks like, did you guys play Final Fantasy VIII? Mm-mm. There's a summon in Final Fantasy VIII named Siren, who is like a, you know, just like ancient Greek looking woman who's like a harpy. But like she's clearly nude, but they do like the Japanese porn thing where it's just like, well, if we just have enough pubic hair and it just goes up her body, this is okay. And I feel like this is almost the exact same color scheme. And I'm just like, yeah, this is someone's fetish.
If they're covered in fur, then technically
are they really if naked? I'll try finding a screenshot of it, but you guys go on while I do that real quick.
Yeah, it was a choice. I don't know, like, I guess to me at this point I was like, what the fuck is this for, like, you know? And also it is, and I think I pointed out before, why are the female Chimera ants the most humanoid? I think we know the reason why. But
okay, Poof's anyways. Pretty humanoid, minus
that's
the wings.
That's Poof, true.
But he's also the most feminine. He kicks after what's that? The most beautiful boy in the world. That vibe that all the mangas took.
Oh, he's shown in. I thought you meant Bishonen, a specific person. I was like, who are you talking about?
A specific person. It was all the Bishonen was based off this one poor child. Hold on.
Oh.
I'm really worried about this
like
now.
Like an actor?
Yes.
Also, click what I just sent you.
Oh, no. Yes, an actor. Yes, it's sad and creepy. I can't. Oh, it doesn't.
It looks like nothing.
It doesn't look like anything.
Oh, the thing I sent you is just like not loading.
Mm-hmm. It's just,
I'll find it.
So the man's name is or the boy at the time, but the man now, is named Bjorn Andresen. He was in a film. He appeared in a film called Death in Venice in 1971. If you look him up, he looks like every single 1970s to 2000 and 2000 or even today's anime boy. Soft features, like that angelic face, like thin lip, like red, like it's very like androgynous almost look. And I think he is credited, or his like face, like the films technically, but he got really popular in Japan, and I think a lot of manga artists took inspiration from that particular man at the time.
Yeah,
do you have some concept as to why?
I actually don't. I don't know like exactly what. Oh, it was a Japanese. The film was in both Swedish, English, French, Italian, and Japanese. So there was a lot of, I think that's how the Japanese audience got a hold of this film. But I think it was just the aesthetic of, I think just like at the time, it's like the Harry Styles of the day, except for I think a little bit more unwitting because he was a regular kid who got cast in this movie. And then
maybe
got,
like the Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah.
It's like the kind of has the same sort of career trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
And I blew up with the one movie with probably a cannibal, Armie Hammer.
After the recent Death in Venice, Anderson spent cannibal. He does eat people, huh? Like sexually. That's a weird thing. But after Anderson spent an extended period of time in Japan and appeared in a number of television commercials and also recorded several pop songs, it is said that his appearance as Tadzio in the film influenced many Japanese anime artists known for their depictions of young, beautiful men known as Bishonen, especially Keiko Takemiya. Anderson has had a strong liking for Japan since he had visited the country over years. Anderson's arrival in Tokyo has been described being similar to the Beatles landing in the U.S. He was met with like mass hysteria and enormous amount of female attention at the time. So in like the early to mid 70s. And then Keiko Takemiya, who did she did Kazetoki no Uta and Tour
so
the Terra
Wind Time Song of the Wind Times.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds right. And then Toward the Terra, which is also a science fiction manga. But yeah, so that's fun. She did a lot of like Shonen Ai stuff. I think that's what that is. So cool little
interesting.
Shoujo.
Impromptu cultural lesson. That's what we come to the podcast for. Actually, it kind of works out. But yeah, to some more stuff that was kind of going on. So as we mentioned, BZF is trying to find Palm right now because like he's kind of wondering what happened to the woman who escaped his ex suburb, I guess. But he's calling and it's noted
can
that
we not
the
call
Khmer
it a
ants,
sex suburb.
Yeah, his like underground sex suburb. You know, it's my new Brazzers show, Sex Suburb.
I really feel like this exists like in real life right
it probably
now.
Does honestly. But basically, it turns out the Khmer ants can hear cell phones because I think they communicate probably at that frequency. And so it's pissing them off because, like, according to Welfin, it kind of sounds like really loud and is very annoying. But Welfin kind of makes a deal with BZF to find Pom based on an article of her clothing. And like, this is all kind of tied into his strategy of sort of finding, you know, like favor with BZF. Like, what do you think he's trying to do with BZF's favor? Because like, while BZF is kind of doing all the administrative stuff that the ants don't want to do, like how long would that last, do you think? Like, what do you think he could actually do with it? Because I think at the end of the day, it feels like without his own strength or like an army that he can move, like this isn't going to do much.
I'm not sure. I think at this rate, he's probably just grasping for straws and trying to influence anyone he can. Because the king and then the royal guards are like at the very top of like the power structure period. He can't even get close to them. Because like when he was talking to Yopi, how dismissive Yopi was of him, he's probably just looking for anyone that he could have some sort of like leverage over, and probably doing that more in terms of numbers and taking account like some level of like influence that they have. So BZF, he's doing the more administrative stuff. Like that's something that Wilfen didn't really have a hand in, but now he does because he has BZF underneath him now. So that, I think that's probably his strategy.
That seems to make enough sense. So something I thought was done really well in this episode was the whole section with Wilfen kind of reasoning to himself about like who to trust and who to talk to. And like, you know, kind of this inner monologue of like, oh, should I reveal this to such and such and such and such? This was clearly done in the manga, but I honestly think this is the one time that I think this sort of monologue was actually done better in the anime. Because normally when they do this kind of strategizing, I prefer it in the manga. But this was pretty good. Like, what did you guys think of it?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good, too. It definitely showed, at least to me, just how even though the ants move or seem like they move like a very cohesive unit, there's not a lot of trust between them. So, like, the dynamics aren't, like, it makes me think, like, what does the loyalty mean between the ants and, like, in between each other?
That's a great point because they literally were born yesterday.
Yeah.
They're literally 3 months old and they're acting off instinct, or like they were acting off instinct at a point, right? That's why they're loyal, right, to each other. Isn't because like they formed a bond like Gon and Killua and all the rest. Like they trust each other because like they have shared experiences, things like that. It's literally because they had to, I guess, or like it was an impulse because they had a queen. And then as they come into their own, they don't necessarily have anything that ties them other than the fact they're all ants, right?
I think it's interesting they kind of mentioned that they had wandered apart, but then with the humans starting to hunt them is when they started working together more again. Because like, remember when the king was like about to be born or was newly born, like all the squad leaders were doing their own thing, and then the humans started coming in and killing people, like killing ants, and they started bonding together again.
So trauma, yeah, bonding.
Yeah, basically.
Common cause in like self-defense, I guess.
Yeah. But that also just shows that can only go so far. Because when, sure, you have to band together out of survival necessity, it just makes people think like, well, you're with me now, but you could stab me in the back later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think this kind of plays back into a theme that was talked about a long time ago, the idea that the ants are becoming more human by virtue of having absorbed human traits. And I think this like level of independence and not having one unified goal and kind of trying to coordinate that is very human. And so it's kind of like seeing like an alien mirror of ourselves.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's just interesting because like, it's like it's the opposite of what you think like a, like, you know, like ants are. Because I watched like the Ants Canada channel on YouTube, and he basically films a bunch of ants, and like they're collectively trying to, you know, dismember, let's say, a grasshopper carcass, and it's like such a unit. And like you think, and I think like especially like, that's probably what the queen wanted, was like all these ants working together to help the king. And it's like the opposite's happening. Like, yeah, obviously they're doing their duty, but they're not really. They're doing stuff that will kind of benefit them, or they made loyalties outside of the king. Let's say, for example, like Hina and Leol, like she's doing stuff for him in terms so it benefits her. She doesn't know that he's dead now, stuff like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even have them siding with the enemy, like Ikago,
yeah, exactly.
Lunarin, and I forgot the other guy.
Which other guy?
The bug?
There isn't it just two?
If you mean Colt, who's like way outside the picture?
Colt? No, there's like a... There's another ant. He looks like a, not a grasshopper, kind of like if the professor from like I don't know how to describe him. Let me find a picture. But
okay, we can come back to that. But Meruem kind of had like a interesting monologue to himself that I thought, I didn't watch this one in Japanese, and I kind of wish I had, because I watched it with the Netflix subs, and this one kind of makes me wonder what they were going for here. Because he asks, like, kind of, you know, to the air monologues, like, who am I? A nameless king in a borrowed castle? If this is the mandate the heavens have brought me. And so the idea of heaven's mandate is like an incredibly Chinese-like idea, like the mandate of heaven. And so I know that, like, sort of, a lot of this is playing on like ideas of East Asian kingship, but I'm like, man, that is like incredibly specifically Chinese rather than like Japanese or Korean. And I'm wondering what you're going for there, or if it's just the idea of it being like ancient. And so like more ancient than Japanese or Korean kingship. But I thought that was like a interesting thing. And that's why I want to watch the Japanese version, just because I'm like, is this rootless or is there like a reason this is here? Any luck, Sarah?
No, maybe I was missing something, but it looked like there was a third person there. Maybe it was a dead aunt or something. I forgot.
Probably.
Never mind. He's like not important enough to really, I guess, have a role. But yeah, I thought the whole political intrigue plot with the aunts was really interesting. The whole discussion between Pito and Meruem about the security plan, I thought that was a really good character moment, because I think before you could kind of see Meruem having a lot of self-doubt in terms of what his role is, what it means to be the king, and then how he reacts to like the three royal guards is basically, I guess, being like a surgical tyrant, like literally smacking Yopi just for being there. And then Pito, he had a pretty solid plan, but he's like, no, never mind, I'll take care of it, your plan is dumb. And then Poof, one thing I found interesting, because it's kind of it's playing into more his doubt of like the king and if he's fulfilling his role. It's like the anxiety and dread. So it feels like a little less like personal than I initially thought, because I thought Poof was more like, oh, the king is not really like acting the way that I like, and more like he's acting in a way that makes me anxious. And I think that's a distinct difference that I thought was really interesting, because I think it's one way to like try, one way to be like, I disapprove, and more like, this makes me like, this gives me a lot of dread, because I think fear versus dislike will kind of make people react in different ways. So that's like one thing that I found really interesting with the whole ant dynamic.
Yeah, and I'd to go along with that, I don't think that Meruem thinks their plans are stupid so much as, like, I think he's actually reacting to his own sense of individuality and realizing that, like, these three who are basically his sworn protectors and, like, he kind of maybe could have previously conceptualized as extensions of himself are other people, and that he doesn't want them, like, constantly around him and to know everything about him. Because he's reacting the way like a child does to first wanting their own space of like, you know, just like pushing like caretaker figures away and like literally like saying, I don't want to be in these safe bounds you've created for me. And that's not to therefore, you know, say that this is dumb on his part. I mean, it kind of is dumb, but this is not to say it's like illogical. It makes sense when you're like seen as like so above these other figures and don't want to be subject to, I guess, like constraints that are put on you by virtue of being this higher figure. And it's kind of like one of the central contradictions of being a king, the idea of like having the power and the choice to do whatever you want, but at the same time being incredibly restricted by the institution that put you there.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. So I think just the fact that he wasn't happy about being in one place, it just remind me of a kid. Like, he's like, no way I'm going to just stay here. How dare you just suggest that? Like, even though it's technically for his own good, he doesn't want it.
Yeah, I think we've previously, many times on this show, contrasted the difference between intelligence and wisdom. And Meruem is more intelligent than any human being could ever hope to be, but, like, is quite wise, but, like, also very emotional. He's I was going to say that he's, like, you know, like, one of those, like, bros who's just like, no, I'm just being logical. I'm not emotional. But that's not true. Meruem does recognize, like, oh, my emotions are getting in the way of my ability to, like, react and act normally. But he's not dealing well with it. So I think in a certain way, he accidentally recognizes, like, my emotional intelligence, you know, that third stat, you know, you got int, you got wisdom, and you got emotional int. It could, you know, do with some work, maybe respect that one.
Yeah. And I think another with group dynamics is with the extermination team. So I feel like they spent a lot of time in that room. So it was like Gnome's dimension, right? I think the back and forth between Yukago and Killua, and then with Knuckles and Killua, basically them being like, you can't overthink Killua, like, chill out. And Killua's like, it's like, you have to expect the unexpected, and to the point where it becomes expected that something unexpected will happen, that sort of contradiction. So I like that. It also makes me a little bit anxious too, because I feel like Killua's the one that, it seems like he's paranoid, but he seems like the most aware in a way. Maybe it's like he comes off as confident, but he's actually unconfident. And that unconfidence is something I feel like is more relatable on my end, because I'm always thinking about the worst of the worst could happen. So I'm more on Killua's side in terms of, like, don't let your guard down. Plan for everything if possible.
Yeah, I think he's... So I'm going to say this as someone who's previously had some major OCD. He definitely sounds like someone with OCD. He literally says the phrase, like, you can't overthink things, you know, like the idea of, like, yeah, there's always more to think about. It's like, that's not true. I know in this case that is true, but, like, just stating that as a general principle, that is not true.
Like, they're literally going to war here, but, like, otherwise, it yeah. doesn't apply.
Like, I think he has a point in this kind of situation with, like, this kind of insane power structure and stuff like that. But even then, there's still a limit to, like, don't overthink things, bro. Like,
right.
He's right that they should expect the unexpected. But beyond that, maybe don't write a couple theses worth of your ideas of what the unexpected could be.
Right. Because at that point, you're running into, like, decision paralysis, and then you'll get nothing done.
Yeah, that's Killua in a nutshell. I mean, it's sort of like, hey, what is the healthy version of how he was previously dealing with the needle in his mind?
Yeah. And I thought it's also because it spent some time just with everyone's inner thoughts. You know, that Gon was, like, focused on Palm's safety. And then he also, I think, like, Killua's emphasis to focus on Pito. So I thought, like, seeing with the Gon's thing, it seems more personal. The stakes that he has versus, like, the other hunters that are more like, this is, like, either the battle of our lives or the battle for humanity. And then Gon is more focused on the individuals that he finds important.
Yeah, and they really underline that by kind of comparing him directly to the king, because at a certain point they sort of talk about the king harming himself, and they theorize, like, why would this be? Like, what would mm-hmm. cause you to possibly harm yourself? And Gon says some shit that if they didn't have only a couple seconds before, you know, the mission was going to start, I think the adults would have been like, hey, man, are you okay? He said, when you can't forgive yourself. And I was like, whoa!
Damn. Oh, God.
These kids got trauma.
It's like he jumped to that conclusion real quick. No context, what was going on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if they weren't just, like, highly, like, just awash in endorphins and about to, like, enter this combat zone, I really think Morel, like a sensible adult, would have been like, hey man, how's it going? Are you okay?
We need to sit. Let's tie out. Let's take a break, both of us together. Talk to me.
Instead, they're just like,
oh, weird shit, kid, but we're going for all it.
Right. You know, you mentioned, it reminded me that, like, you mentioned that, like, Gon's pretty, like, he thought about the people in his life that he cared about, right? And that's kind of mm-hmm. Gon's thing. Because, like, I don't think he, in a weird way, he doesn't care about the greater good. He only cares about people in his close proximity. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's kind of been true throughout the series. Like, mm-hmm. I think he's someone who wouldn't mind a world where the Chimera Ants, like, win, as long as, like, the people around him were safe. And he's just like, I'll just learn to blend into Chimera society, baby.
Yeah. I think that would be Gon's vibe, at least right now, as a child, right? It's very, like, what is the id or whatever? Like the I, or, like, the self, or, like, he doesn't have the id, yeah. So he doesn't have
if we're going into cognitive functions, aka like parts of how you analyze like how you see the world, he has like what you called introverted feeling. So that means he's truly authentic to himself. That's what he prioritizes, and that includes priorities in terms of what he deems important versus the greater good, or what is like what other people around him would consider, I guess, what's best. So he's thinking about what he thinks is best, and that includes like who he cares about. So
yeah,
yada yada. So
that's really cool how like this character so developed that like we could be like, we have some psychological things to work on. Yeah. We can go to therapy right now, honestly. Yeah, we really could with Gon specifically.
Yeah.
Because, like, he even flips. Like, even people who, like, he knows are mass murderers. He's like, well, you're cool with me, so I'm cool with you.
You know, Gon reminds me a lot of Luffy from One Piece. Because I feel like Luffy's on the same wavelength energy. I think Luffy's slightly more altruistic, but not by much.
Right.
He's very much like, well, I care about my Nakama and being the Pirate King. It may be you too because you became my friend, but yeah, whatever. The rest of the world.
It's definitely 90s anime pro tag, right? Where it's not about the greater good, it's about I want to be stronger, I want to be like, I want to make friends, and I want to protect those specific people, and that's it. I mean, let's say Goku, but he does a lot of like world saving a lot of times, but he does make friends with mass murderers pretty easily. Like, he's just like, yeah, this is fine. I can ignore your past grievances.
Yeah.
Just don't do it again, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Oh, Joe, since you said, I was just saying how Gon reminds me a lot of Luffy from One Piece in terms of like priorities and I guess like general attitude towards his people he considers important versus like the general overall good. Yeah. I think a lot of other shonen protagonists are generally like that. I wonder when there was a switch between like the more self, not centered in a bad way, more self-interested shonen pro tags to the more like altruistic bleeding heart shonen pro tags.
Somewhere along the line. So I think Naruto definitely played a part in that. But yeah. I think that both Gon and Luffy are kind of actually sort of deconstructions of that trope, because Goku really is that trope. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. Gon, in a way that we'll get into later, and I don't want to spoil things, is a massive deconstruction. He's that right now, but like it's clear that there's something wrong with the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And Luffy, in his case, I think it's a deconstruction not because Luffy is not that, but because the world really deserves for him to be like, eh, kind of fuck this, because the power structure is such that it's just like, hey, the world's governments have like imposed like tyranny on the world. So I guess, yeah, my anarchic band of like close knit friendship is the only real good.
Yeah, to be fair, they are pirates, like literally pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've only gotten 100 episodes in and they haven't done anything that bad, to be honest, to be like pirates. They're just like, we're here, but they don't steal anything.
Yeah. Like, at worst, they just kind of like, you know, fuck with the government. And we're like, whoops, public destruction. Whoops, we upset your authority in this town. Like, our bad.
But to be like, to save townsfolk, like, it's really.
Right.
It's interesting how that works out.
We can definitely get into this in another episode, but I do think the idea of the small circle of like empathy that many shonen characters have was a certain phase in the development of shonen, and it has changed, but I think you can draw it back to like much older influences such as like Sun Wukong and how like he played into Goku. Mm-hmm. And part of that has to do with like Journey of the West is like a simultaneously a Buddhist and a Taoist text kind of that contrasts the two philosophies. And like Sun Wukong is seen as like the ultimate like Taoist good in that he's like this immortal figure who's like eternally youthful, but he's very selfish and like he's tamed by Buddhism. And so I think this dialectic between helping the world and sort of like helping you and yours has kind of existed in East Asian heroes for like hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah, it's definitely, from what I've noticed, a lot more shades of gray in storytelling, right? Like it's not this guy's bad, we're going to defeat the bad guy necessarily. It's like they're doing something that we don't agree with, but like it's not necessarily that they're evil. Like you get to see both sides, at least in the anime I've watched. So. I can't talk to ancient, or not ancient, but like
to older, ancient anime.
Ancient aliens. we should do a segment one day, like anime therapy, where we just oh, sit man. Down and see if we can diagnose and then cure
so these kids. A podcast I listen to called Mobile Suit Breakdown, which covers Gundam, has a friend of theirs who is a psychiatrist. I forget if she's like, I think she's a psychologist.
That's really cool.
Who comes on and like talks about the traumas of some of the main characters and how they reflected research about those disorders at the time. And therefore, like, it's like, hey, this was accurate to a 1980s Japanese perspective on autism. It's not anymore. Stuff like that, you know?
That's cool.
It is really cool. Do any of you know someone like that? Because we should have them on. But
do we have doctors that are...
Yes, we do have doctors. And I've thought about... We also have a former acupuncturist we know who we could totally bring on to talk about chi.
I'm about to say, yeah. Do we all know a person who's a former acupuncturist?
I do. He's my dad.
Oh, your father. Can we get your father? Because we had my mom on the podcast and it was just a racist nightmare.
Wait, what? Your- okay, she said konnichiwa once. That's not a nightmare. That's just cringe.
Yeah, she's a real cringy lady, my mother. But you can have your dad. Yeah. Bring on your dad.
Sounds good. One last thing that I kind of have that's a note is, you know, with the preternatural ability of like the invasion crew or the extermination, I don't even remember what the fuck we're calling them anymore, to guess at things that happened in the palace. I do think Morel says like one exception is a woman. Reproducing is one of his objectives. And I was just thinking like, the lady who loved insects.
Oh God. Oh no.
Yeah. I was actually thinking that too when they first introduced that line of women, but then it was like, okay, it makes sense that they have like a creepy human that probably needs some sort of incentive to like keep on working with them. But that whole sequence was like weird. It's like funny that they imagined the king instead of like an actual being, they just imagined him as like a vague blob of darkness.
Yeah, because none of them have seen him, so like he's definitely large in their imagination,
right? Because I wonder if it's like if you came across that, you're imagining like this like immensely powerful, terrifying king, you wouldn't really expect it to be like what his height is, like probably what, like 5'10" or something.
I don't know. I also think we didn't remark on this, but in their vision, you know, of Knuckle and Morel in like a very Dragon Ball style way, they're just imagining him fucking hot pom, hot form pom, not creepy form pom. Yeah, that was very lurid. It looked like, have you guys seen the ancient painting / wood carving? It might be a wood carving. The Fisherman's Wife. It reminded me of that, but less explicit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking that too. I was like, oh, well.
Oh, the original tentacle porn.
Yeah,
the original
tentacle
porn,
right? Yeah, it's an ukiyo-e. I couldn't remember if it was an ukiyo-e or like a shunga print.
I think it's ukiyo-e.
Yeah,
I learned about this. They used to use it as like wrapping paper.
Yeah.
Oh. Hey, y'all want tentacle porn wrapping paper?
I remember from Samurai Champloo because I had that one episode about the Ikkyo-e artist.
It does. They used
is
to have
that
Van
the same
Gogh
episode
in there?
Where they have the Dutch guy who's like trying to get sunflower shit?
Yeah, specifically it's Van Gogh.
I think
oh, it's Van Gogh?
Di-
I thought it was just a Dutch dude.
I think it's that's a different episode. That's a little bit later in the series. I think
because Van Gogh was obsessed with Ukiyo-e.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's implied because of the sunflowers, the lily pads, that it's Van Gogh.
I just remember the guy looking too buff, but maybe I'm misremembering.
He was like a redhead.
It's called anime.
Have you seen JoJo? Excuse me.
Van Gojo.
Van
Gojo. Gojo. I mean, that's pretty much what I got for the anime. You guys mind if I do some manga notes? Then we can kind of wrap up our talk of this episode.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, we have a shot of Hina from the manga where definitely can't see the pube carapace she has going on until later. So it was definitely more titillating. I'm titillating. Half like, yeah.
Sorry.
Titillating, yes.
Titillating.
Yes, god damn it. But in this version, Komugi imagines someone robed who kind of looks like a traditional East Asian emperor, which might kind of lend credence to the theory about like the mandate of heaven thing, but I'm not sure still. Additionally, they show Chitu come back a bit earlier and he talks about his new power. Like, this is not shown in this episode, but it is in the manga at this point. In the episode, there was a line where Bizef was talking about the gatherings of people watching the former leader and said it was better than sex. For some reason, the manga, they translated as better than intercourse.
Oh.
And one last difference, there is one last extra frame in this manga chapter that is not in the anime that shows something happening in the sky that says two men jumped off a monstrous creature flying far above Iskorto. And that's all it says.
Oh.
And Sarah, what do you think of this?
Okay, it's not the extraction team because they're all in Nove's, what's it called?
Four-dimensional mansion.
Four-dimensional mansion. Is it like another hunter? The only other hunter involved is Netero, right?
But there's two of them. Don't worry, you don't need to guess this. I just want to see what you think.
Well, I think one of them is Netero. I don't know who the other one is.
Ooh, interesting. Who could the other one be? Who is the masked other person?
Who is the shadowy masked figure from above?
Yeah, it's Genkai.
It's Genkai. It's still Genkai.
It makes sense. If they seem like they would be like arcade buddies and be like, oh, hey, you're going to just exterminate like a bunch of like ants. Maybe I can take a couple for my deadly forests to initiate a bunch of like punk asses.
Oh, I cannot wait till you get to the manga. All of you, actually.
Yeah, I still haven't read the manga after all these years.
Anyway, one last thing. Patrick did the manga notes, so one last thing that's here is he shows that the four-dimensional mansion in the manga is way messier, and boy, is it. I think he's like, yeah, Togashi, what are you doing? And, yeah, Ikalgo straight up just looks like Cartman here. It's kind of great.
He does! He has a little beanie, little coat, and he's just kind of like chilling.
He's baby.
It's interesting because like this is specifically Japanese mess. I know that sounds weird, but like the packaging of the pet bottles are specifically like the water bottles you'd see in Japan, the size of the books. It's like,
did
I
you
don't
go
know
to
why.
Famima? Yeah. That's where you got this.
The Family Mart.
Oh my god, there's a Lawson's box in here?
Yeah, just straight up, no, it's not Lawson's, it's Lason's. It's whatever the weird like switch of a letter is. I don't know why this trash room is like, this is Japanese trash, just the way it's like bagged up and stuff.
I mean, that's how I describe some manga.
Huh?
That's how I describe some manga.
Yeah. Just Japanese trash.
Yeah. I have a rate these deaths note, but frankly, there weren't any. Can you think of any?
Not yet. I mean, everyone who's there is probably going to die, but that hasn't happened yet. All those
Sarah.
Millions of people.
Oh, yeah.
Sarah, while I look something up, could you tell us what you think is about to happen?
Yeah.
Really just predict it for the next 40 episodes. Like, go step by step.
All right.
There's no like... answer, technically. Like, okay. You know what I mean? Like, there is, but there isn't. Like, we're not going to judge you because, like, this is... We never would have predicted what happens.
I feel like definitely they're going to start killing people. Like, at least half of those millions of people are going to die.
Okay.
But half of them will be saved.
Okay.
At least that's what I'm hoping.
It just sounds like you're talking about Revelation now.
Yeah, there's going to be like, oh, it's like one of those crazy angels that has like five eyes and like 10 wings and like one mouth.
Five eyes is really low for angels. I'm going to put it out there.
Is it 1,000 eyes, right?
Yeah, it's like thousands of eyes.
They're like, I think I remember seeing like realistic art, how like they're described in the Bible, and they just look like Monster Rancher characters. Like
or like Bayonetta angels.
Bayonetta angels, yeah. Wasn't it like they took inspiration for that in Bayonetta?
Yeah, in Bayonetta they actually tried to make them look the way they're described in the Bible as opposed to like later writings.
Yeah. And then I think the extermination team, they are going to reach the king, but something's gonna happen where they miscalculate where I don't know, either they
he has
Kamugi's baby. Yeah, he's like, oh wait,
we
a
don't
minute
know the anatomy of ants. Yeah, that makes sense, you know, we don't know.
We did an entire episode about the anatomy of ants, but yeah.
Well, we do know the anatomy of ants. It's not how ants work. I'm sad now.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe Kamugi will play peacemaker in some way, because they gotta know that she's bound to run into them. I mean, she's that's like true. Literally the only other human besides Bizef. I think Bizef's gonna die. He has like, has like death markers all over him. He's not important enough to survive.
You know, that is actually fair.
Okay. I don't know. Wolfen, he seems like has his own agenda. I don't know if it means that he'll side with the humans or he'll just kind of do his own thing and like maybe just run away. And then I think Poof, I don't know, I feel like he's going to turn his back on the king because he's already like not happy with him, not happy how he's going. He's like, oh, I can't, I'm filled with dread and fear. Like, the king, why are you doing this? Why are you? He's going to either go full yandere and be like, I'm going to kill her, or he's going to be like, he's going to abandon him. Either way, I don't think his loyalty is wavering.
What do you think happens with Netero and Genkai? Who it totally is.
Netero and Genkai? I think they'll be the ones who battle the king, because power-wise, they're at that same level. So it could be an even battle.
Remember, Colt, when seeing Netero's like charged up power, was like, there's no way you'll land even a single hit on the king.
Oh, well, maybe two of them.
But psych, he powers up like a super saiyan.
He powers up, you know? Who's like pulls like a Master Roshi or Uncle Iroh the last minute.
Out of everybody, all the characters, who do you think is going to, do you think any, I don't know if I can say this.
Do you think anyone survives?
Yeah, do you think anyone survives?
Oh, well, I think definitely Gon and Killua. They can't just, like, die. Like, they got...
I don't know. People hate this arc for a reason. I
mean, they have too much... Gon, for sure. He has, like, protagonist, main character armor. Maybe Killua if they decide to fridge him, but I don't think they'll go that far. He's too...
Hey, remember, Yusuke died twice for our sins.
But they don't... They don't have that sort of like people can be resurrective mechanic in Hunter x Hunter.
Oh, half the Chimera ants would beg to differ.
Oh, well, that's true. That's not the same though. I don't know. I feel like that Itagashi would get so much backlash if either of them turned into an ant after dying. It'd be like, they would like protest, burn everything sort of deal. I don't know. I don't know. I think probably one of the older hunters, like either Morel or No, may not make it.
Okay.
I hope Knuckle makes it. That's all. It's like, oh, I want that guy to make it.
What about Shoot, though?
50-50.
Wow.
He's like nice, but he's not like good boy Knuckle.
He's nice, but he's fine. He's whatever. To be fair, I think I agree.
Wow.
I think that's all I can really think of now.
No, that's good. I mean, I'm glad you haven't spoiled yourself. Thank you very much for that level of self-control, because I would have just been like, I gotta never read mind. This now.
We'll just pretend. We'll pretend to.
my reactions are genuine. At most, I may be watching like an episode ahead because I forget to press stop. So, but I'm not trying to go beyond that.
That's fine. We're here to announce a special deal for all of our Spirit Hunter listeners.
Wait, what?
If you've had your eye on any of the pink variants of HyperX gear, you can save 15% off during the month of October by using code HXPN, you know, HyperX Penis Network. Oh, it's podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really know. It's Hunter X.
Podcast. Hunter X.
Penis Network.
Philippines.
Oh, gosh.
Night.
Over at HyperX.com. Get yourself an elegant white and pink Cloud 2 or metallic pink Alloy Origins 60 or any of the other pink peripherals on the site. Once again, head over to HyperX.com and get 15% off all pink gaming products with code, remember, this is in all caps, HXPN.
What? So they're just selling their pink shit?
You mean we're selling our pink stuff, Megan? Anyways, speaking of things we're thankful for.
Transitions were flawless.
Let's thank our patrons who helped make this show possible. Tim, Mia, Hanaro, Arthur, Valteri, Mickey, Alexander, and Lucas. Thanks so much, guys. You helped make the show possible. And now a word from our other compatriots and benefactors.
The award-winning Go Nintendo podcast is the best place to get the latest news on the world of Nintendo. We cover the biggest stories, share impressions of the latest games, and answer your burning questions. There's also some general pop culture talk, game music trivia, a heaping helping of silliness, and did I mention our robot companion?
I'm the star of the show.
Catch new episodes of the Go Nintendo podcast every Saturday on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Dunn, host of the O3C podcast. Every week I'm joined by my two best gaming buddies, Chris and Minty, and we talk about the games we're playing, the games we love, and how they rank alongside our sacrosanct top 100 favourite video games of all time lists. Deep dives into gaming mechanics, history and lore abound, all topped off with lashings of irreverent wry British wit, witterings and wisdom. For details on the show and more, head to o3c.games and tune in every Monday on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Welcome back. Hello. Did you like our ads? Were they nice? I don't remember. Who were we adding for? I don't know.
HyperX.
Podcast Network. Penis Network.
That was a mistake on my a legitimate mistake.
Was that a legitimate mistake? I feel
that was
like
a legitimate mistake.
I thought it was a bit.
No, I thought it was a
that
bit.
That was
too.
Not a bit. That was me like midway through being like, I'm an idiot.
P for penis. Anyway, what Y for Yoshihisa Hirano. That was a weird transition.
Yeah.
Definitely not the worst we've had on this network.
Basically, since we're talking about our ads are about headphones, what can you do with headphones? You can listen to music. So this research topic is about the 2011 anime's composer and background music.
That is true. So the person in question is Yoshihisa Hirano. Y is for that name. You will recognize a lot of the shows he's been a part of. Obviously, if you watch Hunter x Hunter, you'll know the music, right? It's all of the jazzy bits, all of the orchestral music. But I'll give you a little background. This is from his website, which I thought was cute. They had a little English version, so I did not have to translate this from Japanese. So I don't actually know if they match, but you know, this is his English version of his biography on his website. But he was born in the Wakayama Prefecture of Japan on December 7th, 1971, having been attracted to Baroque music, which I don't know what that means.
Baroque music is like pre-classic classical music.
That makes a lot of sense. So like before Mozart.
I forget if – I think Mozart might have
– been Baroque.
I don't remember. My periodization of classical music is so bad. Anyways, continue.
That's totally fair. He started studying composition by himself as an elementary school student. He found jazz in high school. He enthused over music of great jazz masters such as Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Eric Adolphy, and John Coltrane, which is really cool to read in his bio.
He's a pretty fucking cool middle schooler.
Yeah, I know. This is a middle school vibe.
This guy's way cooler than us.
He is way cooler. His admiration of them once gave him dreams of becoming a jazz musician, but he then discovered contemporary music. He gained interest in the works of John Zorn, one of the musicians who had the biggest influence on him in his youth. On the other hand, symphonies by Shostakovich, yeah, that makes sense, has also greatly impressed him and helped him make up his mind to study composition seriously. After many twists and turns, he moved to the U.S. He entered Eastman School of Music in New York and studied composition with Christopher Rouse and Joseph Schwantner, getting engrossed in books by 20th century French writers and thinkers, including Bathier, I have trouble with East or Western names. Klosowski, Mandiguis, and Genet. Someone knows who these people are based off of my poor pronunciation. I'm so sorry.
I was going to say, if you know music, you might know these, but yeah. You know, usually while I'm like the pronunciation guy, when it comes to anything remotely French looking, I'm like, I don't fucking know.
No, maybe Tommy just come in and like say, cause he speaks a little French or just at least he did French. Come in and like say these words, please. He spent most of his time reading and composing rather than attending classes.
Damn. He continues being so fucking cool.
He's so chill. Yeah. He's like a jet. He worked with I don't know if this is like true or not, but he worked with the guy who did Death Note, right? The music called Death Note, Hideki got caught for marijuana use in Japan, which is like a big no-no. Fact there. So I'm sure he's real chill. That's all insinuation. That's no real facts. But just based off his bio that he included, it looks like per Wikipedia, he went to Juilliard as well. He didn't mention it in his bio, so I'm assuming he did not like Juilliard.
I have to wonder if that school that we're reading there is a school in Juilliard.
Oh, it could be a school within Juilliard. Okay.
I'm going to look this up.
Okay, yeah. I have no idea how Juilliard works. I just know it from Save the Last Dance or whatever the one where that one lady was really bad at dancing, but we all said, oh, she's great at hip hop and ballet. You know, the 2000s movie. Save the Last Dance. It's Save the Last Dance. Anyway. After many twists.
Is not at all in Juilliard. Okay. It's in Rochester, New York. So when they said New York, they meant like New York.
Got it. I know the Wikipedia mentioned Juilliard, so I'm curious if like he just doesn't like Juilliard. After many twists and turns, he quit the school. He made his debut as a film composer in 2001. Thereafter, he's had composed a large number of soundtracks of TV shows, films, and games, such as obviously Hunter x Hunter 2011. He did Death Note with his weed smoking friend. He did Oran High School Host Club, which if I think about the soundtracks, like not like Kiss Kiss Hall of Love, but like the music, like Poof's theme and stuff like that, mm-hmm. very much makes sense. Like it's like, oh, okay. Which is cool to me. And then Eden Zero, which is that new fairy tale esque show, right? By that same creator. Is that Eden Zero? I could be wrong.
I think so. It's just like sci-fi version of fairy tale.
It's a sci-fi fairy tale. But apparently that's really good, as well as Final Fantasy 13, which I know the Final Fantasy games are very like heavy in orchestral music a lot of times. They're very familiar, so that's really cool. You did a Final Fantasy. I had to pull from Reddit because I am not a music person, so I'm so sorry to anybody who's like music theorists and really, really excited about this segment. But from my limited research, which is a Reddit post, New York News Riot, that like really famous or like the really cool sounding soundtrack, it uses lyrics, and I think we talked about this actually now that I'm reading this, uses lyrics from Requiem Dies Irae,
I think it's Ire.
Which is that thing is a medieval Latin poem characterized by accentual stress and rhymed lines. The meter is thoracic.
Trochaic.
That makes sense to me. The poem describes the last judgment, the trumpet summoning souls before the throne of God, where the saved will be delivered and the unsaved cast into eternal flames. It's known from its use in the Roman Rite Requiem, mass for the dead or funeral mass. So that's just a really cool, just like that one example I thought was really cool to show how much he knows one about classical music, right? And like all the weird little poems that I didn't realize are real words because I'm uneducated. But then also that like he can incorporate it into an anime that makes it make sense, you know?
Is this the battle between the spiders and the hunters and the mafia?
Yeah.
That really dramatic.
It's like the scene. Where he's like standing like Jesus. How fitting. Yeah. Did we talk about this earlier, like a while ago?
We didn't talk about the music. I mean, we did briefly, but we also talked a lot about like my thesis that like Krollo is like the
Jesus
opposite of an opposite of Jesus. He's an anti-antichrist. He's the square root of -1 antichrist.
Well, it seems that Hirano would probably agree with you using the very like Catholic Latin undertones to the music. But it seems a lot taken from Mozart as well. If you look at Mozart's something, it's also called Dies Irae. It sounds very similar to what Hirano did. So that's kind of cool. Just a more fun fact, Yoshihisa was in the hospital for his pregnant wife during the composition of the Hunter x Hunter theme. Both were born at the same time, as he says. So he had twin angels.
What does that mean?
Huh?
Both were born at the same time.
Both children, which are twins, and the Hunter x Hunter, sorry,
okay, were born at the same time. No sense.
Sorry, no, not the wife was born at the same time. The Hunter x Hunter. So the wife was it was a tweet that was translated from Japanese, okay?
That makes way more sense because I was just like, wait, so was his wife in the hospital as an infant being born and sent back in time at a later date?
Yes, absolutely. That was 100% the plot of his life. His wife was pregnant with his twins at the time, and he spent a lot of time in the hospital for his family. So he wrote he composed the Hunter x Hunter theme in the hospital. And he said they were born, it was like born at the same time. So he created a child and the Hunter x Hunter theme and music. he didn't create the child, the wife did. But you know, that's not here or there. He has a really prolific sense of work. He's done a lot. I don't understand music enough, but you can hear the jazzy elements, you hear the classical elements, right? If you pick up like I think it's Kurapika and Killua's like themes, they're a little bit more rock influence, a little bit more modern, whereas I think Luorio's is kind of jazzy.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit of a bop. So you can really hear like his influences. And then like when it gets serious, it's always like this weird, like insane orchestra stuff. Poof's theme is like real sad. It's called like the Lament or something, Lamentoso. They have really cool names, at least in English. I don't know what they are in Japanese, or they might be just the English names.
Latin/Spanish/Latin.
Yeah, right. The Roman character names, I guess I should say. there's a lot of it, and you'll hear a lot of it as this time in the Chimera and arc will progress. It'll be more and more apparent that they're using, because there's a not spoilers, but there's not a crazy amount of dialogue in some scenes within the next couple episodes.
It's all action,
it's
baby.
All music and all action.
Ooh, fun.
Exciting.
Nice. So I also did a little research piece about something that I said last time that Megan couldn't stop laughing at, but it's a story called The Lady Who Loved Insects.
She fucked a bug.
Yeah, she fucked a bug. But I decided to just actually, I'm going to read this out to you. Fun story. I was trying to watch this video, but ran out of time. So I just found a site where you could download the closed captions for it and then, like, you know, read them out. The problem is that I didn't realize these closed captions were automatically generated. So it definitely included some like ways of writing people's names that I'm like, that's definitely not what was said. So I just took them out. So I just replaced them with him or referred to like who they were in relation to the story. So there's a character who's like the son of a noble family, but they definitely just put his name as Emma Nosegay. And I'm like, that's definitely not it. I mean, it's probably like something like Amanosuke or something like that, but I didn't watch the video, so I don't know. So I just referred to him as he.
Mukashi. That's how you start off a story, I think, in Japanese, isn't it? It's Mukashi Mukashi, and then they'll go.
That does sound right, but this is something. This was like a proper noun that they kept on saying.
Oh, nice.
So I'll just read it out real quick. Once upon a time, there was a princess living in a noble family's palatial mansion in Kyoto. She was well known as a very weird princess. This was because she loved insects. The princess always captured various insects outside her room and kept them in cages. All the court ladies of the mansions didn't like insects, so they were scared every time they entered her room. One day, her parents asked her with a troubled face, "You're into creepy creatures who like green caterpillars rather than beautiful insects like butterflies. Why on earth?" The father asked. The princess answered, "Father, people only like things that look beautiful, but I think the beauty within itself is more important than just the appearance." The princess brought one of her insect cages from her room and put it in front of her parents, and inside the cage, there was a butterfly flapping around, which had just come out of the cocoon. "Look, father and mother, this butterfly too was a green caterpillar before it has a cute face now." The princess took the butterfly out from the cage and put it on her palm. Her parents had enough and couldn't argue back. Well, it was only her parents who worried about her, but she seemed not to have any interest at all. The princess said it would be best for humans to stay natural, just like insects, so she never wore any makeup. Quick note, I think this is a slight mistranslation where what she actually, if I remember correctly, we'll talk about it later, she actually doesn't blacken her teeth, which is a thing we'll talk about after this.
Oh, I thought that was something that was, maybe it's a different culture, that was a beauty.
It was in Japanese culture at this time. People would blacken their teeth, but it turns out there was also a functional reason. It was like the best way to preserve your teeth before brushing your teeth existed.
Oh, so it wasn't like purely aesthetic.
It wasn't purely aesthetic, and so it was used throughout Southeast Asia as well, not just Japan, but Japan was like one of the countries outside of Southeast Asia that did it. But anyways, the court ladies were always talking behind her back. However, it was time to think about marriage, even for the princess. One day, a son of a noble family heard about the weird princess. The son liked weird and interesting stuff, so he thought of making fun of the princess. You know, that strategy, just neg this girl. He wrote a letter, then sent it to the princess. The letter said, "I want to come to you, even if I have to crawl around on the ground. I am longing for you, just like my body is long and this will never change."
That's just so, "I'm gonna wriggle for you, girl, wriggle."
I think this is maybe slightly mistranslated, but let's just go with it. When the princess opened the bag which came with the letter, a dead snake came out. The court ladies screamed and ran out. The color of the princess's face did not even change, and she said, "No matter what creatures they are, as long as they live, they're family and precious friends. You shouldn't hate them recklessly."
Wait, but they're dead. It was a dead snake.
Yeah. Apparently, but I think she's saying you shouldn't be afraid, even if it's dead.
Okay.
First of all, this snake is a fake, which looks so much like the real one. The princess sent the letter back to him with a fake snake, just like the way he did.
This is a beautiful poem.
It said, "I would like to meet you in heaven if we ever have a chance. I am sorry, but I don't like you being around me with such an appearance." I feel there's some metaphor there that I just don't understand because I don't understand
so
Japanese.
So it's not a fake snake.
I think it is a fake snake.
It's a fake snake. Wait.
So she sends back another fake snake and is like, "I don't like you with this appearance. Maybe show up for real." I think the implication. I'm not sure.
Got it. Like, you're not presenting your accurate self here.
Keep in mind, you're getting this third hand.
This is like a fifth hand. It's like a translation based on somebody, and then someone telling the story.
Based on Google text YouTube. To speech or speech to text.
Okay.
Huh. I see. I thought she was just a weird princess, but she seems unexpectedly clever. Because of this, he became more interested in the princess. And a few days later, he dressed like a lady and sneaked into the mansion where the princess lived. While he was walking in the hallway of the mansion, he found the princess joyfully catching insects with young male servants at a courtyard.
Oh, fucking scandalous. She a ho.
Yo, maybe they're eunuchs. We don't know. This could be mistranslated. Oh, that's the princess we've been talking about. She really doesn't seem to wear makeup. He saw elegance and beauty from her natural appearance.
Oh, she's not like other girls.
To be fair, she was not like other girls.
She really wasn't.
Oh, you don't look familiar. Are you new here? Said a court lady who stood behind him without him noticing. Yes, I am.
What a weird detail to bring out.
He tried to leave there immediately, but because he was rushing so much, he stepped on the bottom of his kimono and fell over hard. Oh no, when he fell over, his female haired style wig came off at once and rolled on the hallway. The woman says, "You're a man, oh no, run." He started to run away at the same time the court ladies were screaming from behind. Ever since, when he wrote her countless numbers of love letters, the princess never noticed his feelings and just sent him back letters that did not respond to him.
What? Oh, okay, wait,
like, what letters did she send him? That makes no sense.
Okay, like she
returned to sender.
I'm unsure. I think this is part of the possible mistranslation. Oh, I forgot. You know how we were saying it's fifth hand? It's probably more like sixth hand, because I also think this was done in rhyme, in metaphorical language, using kanji.
Like,
in imitation of classical Chinese poetry, is my guess. And so probably we're missing a ton of context.
Yeah.
But for that, I've gone to Wikipedia and found some Western cultural critics descriptions of like what their thoughts on it.
Before we read this, can we just like try to analyze it ourselves based off the bad Google translation?
Yeah. So I think with at least for the ending, it was less like she would continue to send letters probably to his like address, but instead of writing to him, she was writing at him. So she just like wrote like whatever she wanted.
Fuck you, like, my bugs are best.
It was like, oh yeah, I love these bugs. Like, oh yeah, I discovered this new thing today. And like not even say like, I'm thinking of you. She's just like writing whatever she wants and just sending it.
Oh, that didn't return her his feelings. Like,
right. Yeah. She's just like oblivious. Yeah, like sure. It's whatever. He's a pen pal, but she not just a pal, like just a pen receiver.
Pen receiver. Wait, so let me get this straight. She likes bugs. She's like a weird, she's quirky. She's a manic pixie dream girl.
She's a manic
feudalist Japan
buggy dream girl.
Dream girl, yeah. So she's actually just Zooey Deschanel. So she likes bugs. She's a little wild and free. But then this guy's like, I want to court her, so I'm going to wriggle like a worm. And then she sends her a fake dead snake? Or like, was he trying to bully her? And then like, I think decided like, oh fuck, she's hot.
Interested. And okay. So when he got the response of the snake back, he's like, oh shit, sick burn. This girl's kind of cool.
It's one of those things where I think it's like a more... It's a very niche thing. It's like, you know, I love a niche genre of like romance and shoujo anime and manhwa called Otome Isekai. And one of the memes about it is, because it shows up in every story, is that the male love interest will look at like the female main character and see that she acts in a way that's like unusual for like women at the time. And he goes like, interesting.
Like,
and that's basically
girls.
What happened here. He was like, interesting. She's different.
She built different.
So I definitely think this is like something that obviously occurs in Western culture and like media, but I think it's like very prominent in Japanese stuff, specifically because of how more regimented society is regarding like people's roles and expectations. And that's also why you see so many shonen heroes as like, you know, convention breaking like new messiah type figures. But do you guys want to continue with your analysis, or should I move on to some historical context?
Like, manic pixie girl, like manic butterfly girl or something.
Oh, a manic butterfly girl. I like
that's my
it.
Favorite DDR song.
Yeah.
It's a little butterfly.
I guess it's like I find it interesting in a way, because she like, aside from being a princess and acting unusual, it also makes her even more, let's say, unreachable or untouchable towards, like, people don't understand her, but also people who want to get to know her can't, because they're not even in her level of, like, perception. She's like, oh, yeah, whatever.
She's unbothered.
Yeah, unbothered. So it's interesting that someone who takes so much priority over, like, small little creatures like bugs, who most people seem insignificant, doesn't even notice, like, other human beings and people who are interested in her. She just doesn't prioritize it.
Yeah, I definitely think that is something interesting to think about, and I'm not going to spoil the context, but I think you've kind of hit on some of it. Do you guys have any more guesses?
Yeah, it just feels like it's like what the childhood thing where it's like he bullied a girl and then he realized he liked it. It's like, oh, it's Flipped. Have you guys ever seen the...
No.
The eighth grade coming of age tale Flipped, where it goes between, like, these two kids, and it's one girl's, like, really weird and, like, quirky. She likes her... She hatches chickens or something like that. And then the boy, typical 50s, it takes place in the 50s for whatever reason, boy... like, really, he hates her because she's weird, but then ends up falling for her in the end. So that's, it's Flipped.
Sends her a chicken.
Do you think, yeah, for a chicken. But before he throws away her eggs and makes her really mad. And then they don't end up together because he's a dick the whole time. And she just wants to, like, hug a tree. Yeah. But that's this story, I think, now that I think about it.
Well, I think she just doesn't notice him.
Oh, okay.
So, for some context, Mushi Mezuru Himegimi is the 12th century Japanese tale of one who defies social conventions and breaches the decorum expected of a Heian court lady. It's one of 10 short stories in the collection Tsutsumi Tsunagon Monogatari. The protagonist befriends insects, names her attendants after them, and engages in poetic exchanges involving furry caterpillars, leading to laughter at the part of others.
Wait, she names her attendants? So, like, she's naming people with their own names after bugs. You're worm.
Yo, but she likes it's a sign of respect on her part.
I guess.
Affection, I mean. So portrayed as even more eccentric in her disregard for her physical appearance, she leaves her hair untrimmed, has unplucked eyebrows, and neglects to blacken her teeth, and allows herself to be seen by men. Oh, how regrettable. Why does she have such a weird mind? When an incipient love affair comes to an end along with the tale, it is of little surprise to any of the observers. Significant debate about interpretation: is she to be celebrated or mocked? UCSB scholar Robert Blackus argues that argues that the modern reader may prefer her independence and naturalness to quote-unquote the excessive artificiality of Heian conception of feminine beauty, but he also draws parallels with anecdotes told of Fujiwara Munosuke, the beekeeping minister who gave his favorite names such as Long Legs, aka Ashitaka, which I'm now wondering is the origin of possibly one of the characters from Princess Mononoke. Translator Donald Keane suggests that while modern Western reader might care to celebrate her independence of mind, this may be ahistorical and the text may be mocking her. Meanwhile, UCLA professor Michelle Mara points out that the independence of thought may have actually been celebrated at the time as a Buddhist truth preferred over the values of Fujiwara aristocracy of the Heian period. And this kind of disagreement about whether this is to be celebrated or thought of as childish actually really parallels a lot of stuff from interpretation of Don Quixote. Like, have you guys ever read that? For some background, I have not read it, but I just know a lot about how it's kind of interpreted.
No, I only really know about the grocer, or the weird store in Japan called Donkey.
Yeah, we read it. You did, right?
Yeah, but I just don't remember much.
I think it was in many ways a parody, in the sense that Don Quixote was the text didn't hide the fact that he was delusional, but at the same time it showed some sense of care and how it didn't completely mock him. Like, there was some sincerity in his delusions, and that was something to be admired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's also like some people who interpret it as like, wow, if everyone else around you is fucking miserable, why not just go into this deluded world of illusion, like this deluded world of fantasy? And so like, I wonder if it's like one of those cases where you can kind of make an argument for both, like whether or not, you know, we personally agree with them. There's something interesting to be had there. So I also decided, we're just making this the Komugi Hour, but I decided to look up some possible origins for a name. And on searching it, I found the term Mugi, because Ko is usually like a term meaning child and usually in girls' names. So I just looked up Mugi, and the most likely thing I could find is a Japanese phrase meaning shamelessness. This second part might not apply as much, but it says shamelessness even while committing evil acts. But I think that might have been editorializing on the part of Wiktionary, though it's possible it's in other definitions as well. But it comes from two words, mu, meaning without, and ki, meaning ashamedness or shyness. But it comes from a more ancient Chinese phrase, which in Middle Chinese was saying like miao kui, meaning with clear conscience. So Mandarin, it would be like wu kui, and Cantonese, it would be mo kui. And so I think the idea is that she's guiltless rather than that she is shameless, because I think shameless in English kind of has like a intention of disregard. So it's mm-hmm. she is guiltless and shameless is how I would think of her rather than one or the other. Finally, I think I've kind of mentioned the idea of the 1001 Arabian Nights, and I'm just going to make this highly abbreviated. But I think Komugi may reflect the character Shahrazad, and that might be different than how you've seen it written, but that's because this is the more correct pronunciation based on like Persian that it was based on rather than the French translation of an Arabic text. But yeah, it's a woman prolonging her own life by teaching a misanthropic king about the value of human life and human nature through tales of the diverse experiences of humankind at its best and worst.
Oh.
And so there's a little bit there.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, she's already having an effect on him in terms of questioning, like, what is life worth living? Like, is it the physically strong, or is it other strengths that are seen as worthwhile and that life should be preserved? So, and he is also stuck in his castle for how many days?
Yeah. So one thing that's interesting that you do not see reflected in this is in the 1001 Arabian Nights. I'm reading it currently, but like spoilers for like a really old book. But like at the end of it, there's a part where, yeah, at the end of it, there's like a part where they're just like, the king just noticed that Shahrazad was holding a baby and was pregnant. And like, he basically is like, yes, I love you. And then she's like, yeah, we've had like three kids while I was telling you these stories.
Oh, it's How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah. Ted Mosby, famous king of Persia.
Oh, man.
Classic. I can't wait till they make the sequel series to How I Met Your Mother. The Prince of Persia, starring Jake Gyllenhaal.
As a real Persian prince.
Yeah, oh, authentic man. Persian, Jake Gyllenhaal. Happy Nowruz, y'all. Anyways, that's what I got. I'm curious what you guys think of it before we kind of take out the episode.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I'm kind of like seeing like connections between the story and Komugi, just like kind of twisting people's expectations. Mm-hmm. I guess it's like someone that you think you could kind of dismiss as odd, having some sort of like outlook on life that can change your own. I feel like Komugi and Miro will probably have a more mutual relationship compared to this guy and the princess, because he seems like he has been like a servant zone or something, because she doesn't even notice he's there.
Wait, what zone did you say?
Like, not servant zone, but she thought she didn't really.
I got servant zone.
She didn't even notice, like, ignored zone.
The ghost zone.
Yeah. Oh, the wait, what the fuck was the name of that thing in Dragon Ball Z that was in a filler saga? Dead zone. That was it. Zone. Fucking dead zone.
Komugi, it's interesting because I just pulled up a picture of Komugi and you mentioned the unkept eyebrow. Did you mention the unkempt eyebrows?
Yeah, I mentioned unkempt
eyebrows. Yeah, I mean, that's like definitely like a trope right? Like a comedic trope in Japan, like from way back when, right? In like Japanese literature and like manga and things like that, where like the comedians would put on like the mask and like they had like a bad mole with hair and then like the thick eyebrows and like all that stuff, right? So I mean, it could be that, but it's also the bug. It reminds me of the bug girl, right? Because she's like not mm-hmm. conventionally. We all love Kabuki, right? Because she's the best, but like conventionally attractive for what. Even within the anime, you can tell like he tried to make her look as unkempt and gross looking, like with the snotty nose yeah. and like the fuzzy eyebrows and like the hair, man, that thing's matted. Like those aren't like hair ties, those are mats, I swear.
Ooh, yeah.
She has two gross dreads.
Lol. Something I forgot to mention, but it occurred to me earlier, like Megan, correct me if I'm wrong, but Mushi means insect, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, the character Mushi, like in the Chinese, like literally just means snake rather than insect. And so I half wonder if the dead snake thing was a pun.
Oh, like, let me see. I'm Googling the kanji for Mushi.
And I also wonder if the Mushi thing is also related to her name, like Mugi, Mushi, insect, insect, shameless child.
Shameless child. It's different for Hebi. It's Hebi. It sounds like shrimp.
Oh yeah, like I understand that there's a different character in Japanese, but I think the Mushi character is just insect in Chinese.
Oh, I got you.
And yeah. I don't know why that divergence happened. That's something I remember. I could be wrong. So listeners, hit us up.
No, you're right. So Mushi, in the past, it was just, this is a random website. I have no idea who this is. Past, it was thought that animals were divided into furries, kemono.
What?
Furry animals. It's like how you divide animals up, right? Furries, fishes, birds, and literally everything else was Mushi. So you had the furries, the fishies, the birdies, and then everything else was Mushi. Hence why the term is so broad even today. So you can tell.
Interesting.
I think I remember learning about this. You can tell an animal was considered to be a Mushi because its kanji has the that radical that you're talking about, which means like it's in snake. So for example, frogs have that same radical, which is like, I can't explain it because we're not a visual podcast. And snakes, Hebi, have the same radical. They don't have fur, so they were considered Mushi because they're not a fish, they're not a bird, they're not a furry, they're a Mushi. So Mushi isn't the same thing originally. Maybe now it is, right? But like, it's kind of like how the color Midori didn't exist, the color blue or green didn't exist in Japan. The same thing didn't, like a bug, like a snake was a bug, like they're this, like an ant and a snake were the same, like in category wise versus like in verbal communication versus in, I know technically they're different, but you know.
Curious. I was going to say that's definitely a research topic for another day. Then I'm like, no, it's not. I'm not coming back to this.
We're never coming back to Mushi for Mushi, which Mushi.
Unless we cover Mushi Shi, we're not doing this.
Mushi Shi. Oh, that is a whole thing. Common Mushi are flies, cockroaches, spiders, caterpillars, snakes. So it probably was a snake that they, or worms. So it really probably was a dead snake because that's considered Mushi, right? If she loved
So I wonder if basically he's like, oh, this girl is clever creatures. For getting my linguistic pun. And then she's like, I don't know, I was throwing a snake at you, but whatever.
whatever, man. So yeah, that's kind of fun there.
Yeah, sounds good. Anyways, thank you guys so much for listening to the Spirit Hunters. Please hit us up with questions, requests, or just to chat at our Facebook or Twitter at Spirit Hunter Pod. Heads up, check us out at patreon.com/spirithunterpod and join our public Discord where we'll be discussing the shit out of Hunter, Yu, and much more. I like how I'm saying we'll be doing that, but we are doing it now. People actually are talking about it. So if you want to be part of those people, part of our world, you should come.
Fun fact, humans are Mushi.
I was about to ask if we were Mushi or not, but I was like, I don't want to prolong this.
We don't do it anymore. We're not Mushi anymore, but like...
Oh, we used to Mushi.
We used to Mushi real hard. I'm so sorry for anyone who actually speaks Japanese and are like, what are you saying?
Okay, I was honestly thinking of like whatever Greek philosopher it was that called humans featherless bipeds. And so someone like just like removed a bunch of feathers from a chicken and they're like, behold, a man. But anyways...
This is speaking of the Discord. Of man.
Speaking of the Discord, if you want to support us another way, you can help us by giving us a written review on Apple Podcasts. Each review gets a service to tens or hundreds more people. Finally, today's intro and outro, which you'll be hearing for the last time because we're actually switching in next episode. Ooh. The themes were made by Rifty Beat and Lightest Dalion, respectively. Check them both out on YouTube. Also, big shout out to our editor, Tommy. Thanks to him, the rest of the crew can focus more on doing research and talking to Gashi. Where else are you going to find out about the origin of Mushi? See you on the other side.
See you on the other side.
Bye, guys.
Bye.